festive houses went up. An Italianate villa, and the first built on West Broad Street. William Arnold's house cost $6,000 to build. King and his family bought the villa in 1980. Although the Queen City, as Mainers call her, is no longer the king of the lumber industry. Entire forests still fall to provide printing paper for the new king in town, whose books sell worldwide. The widow who sold them her house had no idea that, at 33, Stephen King was already a multimillionaire because of the three-book deal with New American Library that Macaulay engineered. After watching the Kings walk through the house and hearing Stephen say he wanted to buy it, the widow spoke to the realtor afterward to express her concerns. "He seemed like such a nice young man," she said, "but could he really afford a house that cost $135,000? The realtor assured her that the Kings could afford the house. For Tabitha King, the house, bought with money earned from books that tapped into people's nightmares, was a dream come true. As reported in the Bangor Daily News, as a girl, she strolled down West Broadway with a friend and dreamed of living in one of the mansions. She leaned toward the red one with towers. She certainly never thought she'd live there one day. But the wide-eyed girl grew up to be author Tabitha King, and married the man who became the most famous horror author of our time, Stephen King. He decided the barn-red Victorian mansion at West Broadway, replete with towers, secret passages, and unbeknown to them at the time of purchase, a ghost, was his kind of place. "I thought it was destiny," said Tabitha. The 23-room house was certainly big enough for the family of five, Stephen, Tabitha, and their three children. The house would also serve duty as home offices for both writers, and at least temporarily, house secretaries too. Wanting to preserve what little privacy they could, the Kings eventually moved the office out of the house and into a nondescript building near the Bangor Airport. The major home renovations included a front porch, a carriage port, an indoor pool, 47 feet long, with windows in a climate-controlled underground library housing 17,000 volumes and numerous interior modifications. In the beginning, the Kings were reluctant to put up a fence and had hoped a small placard near the door, explaining that the Kings were working writers and couldn't be disturbed, would be enough to deter the tourists with books they wanted signed. But as they found out, that wasn't enough to deter the curious. The tourists still came up to the door bearing books. "Surely," they thought, "Stephen King can make an exception this time just for me." Stephanie Leonard, King's sister-in-law, wrote in Castle Rock, "Why do they come by? To take a picture of the house, hoping to catch a glimpse of its residents coming and going? To get a book signed or to knock on the door and hope to pass a word with the author of the books they carry? To see the house that is now familiar to them from magazines and calendar covers? All of the above." Terry Steele on the King's Fence, from Fine Home Building, October-November 1983. I brought a lot of magazines showing examples of ironwork to my first conference with the Kings, along with a lot of photographs I'd taken of fence and gatework around Beacon Hill in Boston. The Kings also had books with drawings of ironwork, and we discussed possible designs. It was important for the fence and gates to work with the architecture of the house, to be graceful and attractive, and yet reflect the personalities of the occupants as well. King, a writer of macabre fiction, wanted bats worked into the design. His wife wanted spiders and webs. We walked the property line, and I recorded the length of the fencing perimeter and the width of the sidewalks where the gates would go. We got a survey map and found some old photographs of the property. It looked about 5 feet high, and we decided on the same height for the new fence. Next, I studied the house's architectural details. My eye was caught immediately by the attractive wooden appliqué on the south sidewall of the house, whose design had been borrowed, I was certain, from classic wrought iron scroll work. I borrowed it back for the fence design. It shows up in the support sections and in the side gate design. The stained glass windows throughout the house offered another design possibility. Their arches and radius lines gave me an idea for the design of the spider webs. The front gate, with its circles and arches, repeat motifs I found over the doors and the back barn's circular windows. After the initial brainstorming session, I went home and worked up a proposal, including design drawings and cost. Once the Kings approved the picket and fence section design, I drove back to Bangor to take exact measurements. After consulting with the Bangor Historical Society, we got a building permit. The commission took a year and a half to finish. 270 lineal feet of hand-forged fence, weighing 11,000 pounds, punctuated by two gates composed of spiderwebs, goat heads, and winged bats. The editor of the local paper called the project a major contribution to the architecture of the city of Bangor. A neighbor comes over to tell me the fence is just what the house needed, and turns to eye her own front yard. One thing's for sure. Anyone touring Bangor trying to pick out the house where Stephen King lives will have little trouble finding it. Of course, on Halloween, the house is spook central. In the past, the Kings used to hand out candy, but when thousands of children began showing up every year and the police cruisers parked on West Broadway to handle the crush of crowds, the Kings realized that even that simple pleasure would be denied to them. They couldn't just blend in with the neighbors, especially not on Halloween. These days, the Kings are either gone on Halloween night or they're home, with the main lights turned off to ward off the trick-or-treaters who are drawn to the house. Understandably, what was perhaps King's favorite holiday quickly became his least favorite, at least in terms of trick-or-treating. Bats and spiders. I had a design flash, a moment of creativity as the design of the gate emerged. I had the concept and drew it on the chalkboard. Then I started making it, putting it together. I was pretty much done when Tabitha drove down to my workshop in southern Maine to take a look. Steve initially said he wanted creatures like bats and spiders, so the front gates incorporates them. Drawn from the fear imagery that we as children had of the creatures of the night. That seemed to me to be where King was coming from in his writing. I wanted the gate to say something about the person behind the door. Also on my visits, I noticed a lot of comic books lying around, including Superman and Batman. Remember the bat symbol that is flashed on the clouds in Batman? That's what I used for the two bats on the fence. Superhero, not demonic characters. Terry Steele. In an interview with George Beam. 28. Firestarter, 1980. Incendiary Novels. In Art of Darkness, King remarked to Douglas E. Winter that when he ran into problems writing The Dead Zone, he put it aside to work on Firestarter instead and realized that it echoed to a strong degree his first published novel, Carrie. He told Winter, "I had this depressing feeling that I was a 30-year-old man who had already lapsed into self-imitation." Carrie is the story of a teenage girl with a wild talent who unleashes it to devastating effect, and Firestarter is the story of a teenage girl who has a wild talent that allows her to unleash her power also to devastating effect. But King, an English major who went back to teach at his alma mater, reconciled himself with the notion that he wasn't simply rewriting Carrie. He was attempting to amplify themes that are intrinsic to his work. Firestarter, however, never became a household word like Carrie. As Collings pointed out in a review published in The Stephen King Companion, 1995, with the possible exceptions of Cujo and Christine, probably no other single King work has attained to such a level of popular culture, mass name recognition. Now, four decades later, Carrie still carries the day. As a movie poster for the 2013 Carrie movie proclaimed, "You will know her name." Firestarter is the story of a teenage girl named Charlene Charlie McGee, who shares much in common with Carrie. As John Grisham explained in an introduction to the New American Library collector's edition of the novel, the bad guys pursue with a vengeance, and the chase is on. The government wants Charlie in custody, in a cell someplace, so she can be drugged and controlled. The government wants to study Charlie, to watch her make fires, to measure the incredible heat she generates, and to use her as a weapon. In the end, stated Collings in The Stephen King Companion, 1995, Firestarter is a mid-range King novel, certainly an interesting read, but representative neither of his strongest nor of his weakest works. It lacks the breadth of plot and setting that elevate earlier novels such as The Shining or The Stand to the level of masterworks and potential classics of contemporary American letters. And it equally lacks the cosmic scope of later works, including It, The Talisman, and Insomnia, that expand readers' horizons and expectations to something approaching epic intensity. Michael Whalen's Firestarter Painting. It can be seen in Knowing Darkness, artists inspired by Stephen King. Michael Whalen's art has graced several King books, the first being a cover painting for the Fantasia Press limited edition of Firestarter, which was issued in a run of 725 signed copies. King, though he's no artist himself, has a fine sense of art and design, and is an ardent collector of original art based on his fiction. In October 2014, Whalen's original 24-by-32-inch painting for Firestarter went up for sale at Heritage Auctions in Dallas. It had belonged to bookseller John McLaughlin of the Book Sale in California, who had offered it years ago in a book catalog for $35,000. King admired the painting so much that he chose Whalen to illustrate The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger, 1982. Whalen was asked to illustrate the second book in the series, The Drawing of the Three, 1987, but previous commitments to other publishers made that impossible. Whalen even turned down what he termed two dream assignments, illustrating The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings for their 50th anniversary editions, citing a too-heavy workload. As Whalen said in The Stephen King Companion, 1995, "Both nearly drove me crazy because I tried every way I could to work them into my schedule, but it was impossible." Whalen's Firestarter painting is a high watermark in the fantasy illustration field. Your eye is immediately drawn to the young girl in the wraparound cover art, Charlie McGee, the focal point of the novel and the illustration. Look closer, though, and you'll see in the foreground charred bodies, which graphically display her wild talent, her pyrokinetic power. But for all of her power, she's an orphaned child, an outsider, though perceived by one of the characters in the book as a monster. But she's no monster. She's just a scared teenage girl on the run, though she harbors a latent, devastating power. As Whalen wrote in his coffee table book, The Art of Michael Whalen, "After reading Stephen King's Firestarter, there was only one image I could envision for the cover. The moment of the supreme realization of the protagonist's power. A look of trance-like fascination, as if she were enthralled by the experience of her power blossoming into fullness." To me, Carrie must have had a similar moment of awareness when she, too, realized she had a devastating power that remained hidden until triggered by external forces. In Knowing Darkness, Whalen explained, "In three of my favorite books of his, Salem's Lot, The Shining, and Firestarter, it's the sense of love and self-sacrifice between the protagonists that's very convincing to me as a father. I find myself identifying with the main character in these three books." Fantasia Press. In a footnote in Danse Macabre, King writes affectionately about Arkham House, a a small press well known to aficionados of fantasy, science fiction, and horror. What he says about Arkham House can be said about all the small presses, of which there are many, that have published King's own limited editions. There is probably no dedicated fantasy fan in America who doesn't have at least one of those distinctive black-bound volumes upon his or her shelf, and probably in a high place of honor. August Derleth was the founder of this small Wisconsin-based publishing house and an editor of pure genius. Arkham was the first to publish H.P. Lovecraft, Ray Bradbury, Ramsey Campbell, and Robert Bloch in book form. And these are only a few of Derleth's legion. He published his books in limited editions ranging from 500 to 2,500 copies, and some of them, Lovecraft's Beyond the Wall of Sleep and Bradbury's Dark Carnival, for instance, are now highly sought-after collector's items. It's worth noting that Conan creator Robert E. Howard's first book, Skull Face and Others, was also published by Arkham House. And yes, Arkham House titles are collectible, some commanding thousands of dollars. The publisher of the first limited edition of any Stephen King book, Fantasia Press, opened the way for the other presses who followed, issuing splendidly illustrated, beautifully bound books in small print runs. Whispers Press, Everest House, Mysterious Press, Donald M. Grant, Publisher, King's Own Filtrum Press, The Land of Enchantment, Scream Press, Lord John Press, Alfred A. Knopf, Doubleday, Mark V. Zesing Books, Cemetery Dance Publications, Centipede Press, Subterranean Press, P.S. Publishing, and others. Much of the art from these limited editions can be found in Knowing Darkness. 29. Dark Forces, The Mist. You're supposed to visualize that entire story in a sort of grainy black and white. Stephen King, Tampa Tribune, 1980. This is what happened. Anthony Cheatham, the publisher of Futura Publications Limited, recommended that Kirby McCauley edit an anthology of new stories of horror and the supernatural for him to publish, which could in turn be published elsewhere around the world, as McCauley recalled in the introduction to his anthology, Dark Forces. Published in 1980, Dark Forces had to have a contribution by Stephen King, then one of McCauley's clients. In short order, King contributed The Mist, which became the lead story in Dark Forces, New Stories of Suspense and Supernatural Horror. It was also the lead story in King's anthology, Skeleton Crew, for the same reason. The strongest story in the book gets the lead position, to draw in readers. The tale grew in the telling, as McCauley recounted in his introduction. 70 pages, then 85 pages, then 100 pages, and finally 145 manuscript pages totaling 40,000 words. I expected an ordinary length story and ended up with a short novel by the most popular author of supernatural horror stories in the world, McCauley wrote. In his notes to Skeleton Crew, King explained that the story was written in the summer of 1976, when he and his family were living in Bridgeton, in a house on Long Lake. Stephen King, in the aftermath of a storm, made a run to the supermarket when my muse suddenly shat on my head. This happened as it always does, suddenly, with no warning. I was halfway down the middle aisle, looking for hot dog buns, when I imagined a big, prehistoric bird flapping its way toward the meat counter at the back, knocking over cans of pineapple chunks and bottles of tomato sauce. I was amusing myself with a story about all these people trapped in a supermarket, surrounded by prehistoric animals. The resultant story, pitting ordinary folk in a supermarket besieged by monstrous creatures, is classic King story, and a classic horror story as well. King, who takes delight in putting ordinary people in extraordinary situations, knows that a pressure cooker environment is ideal for stripping away the thin veneer of civilization, revealing people's true nature, sometimes good and sometimes not so good. He revisits this theme in Storm of the Century and Under the Dome. The Mist is a full-blown horror story and apocalyptic fiction at its best. Out of seemingly nowhere, for no apparent reason, monsters emerge out of a mist to attack. No one is safe. As Michael Collings wrote in The Stephen King Companion, 1995, the length of a short novel, this story of unknown horrors suddenly descending on an unsuspecting humanity, contains in miniature the distilled essence of King's storytelling. It showcases virtually every technique, device, theme, twist of characterization and plotting, landscape and atmosphere that King's readers respond to so strongly. Its story is simple. One day, out of nowhere, a mist settles over a small town. A number of people, including the narrator and his son, are trapped in a supermarket when the first monsters arrive. From then on, the trapped handful of people battle for survival against the mist and the shadowy horrors it hides, and, in some ways more frighteningly, against themselves. Finally, a small group leaves the market to try to drive to safety, or at least to discover if there is an end to the mist. The story concludes with their holing up for the night in the lobby of a Howard Johnson's. The mist is still out there, and so are the monsters. Worse, instead of becoming familiar with continued exposure, the monsters seem to be even more alien, larger, more threatening. But as the final lines indicate, there is also hope. Out of darkness and death emerge optimism, a thin thread of hope that keeps the survivors struggling to survive. With its microcosmic scope, its emphasis on human types as well as on individuals, and its constantly transmuting monsters that take on the force of allegories for psychological states, The Mist taps into archetypal patterns of fear and strength, horror and hope. It is one of King's most tightly focused stories, presenting the illusion of vast human experience in an unusually compressed format. A quintessential King story, and one of his finest, it was also adapted as a film by Frank Don't Send Me Back to Prison Darabont, with a reimagined ending that is bound to disappoint some reader viewers because of its overt optimism and finality, in contrast to the published story's more nebulous ending, which evinces only a glimmer of hope. There are also two splendid audio versions of The Mist, including an unabridged reading by Frank Muller and also a dramatization, which succeeds brilliantly for the same reason that radio shows like Arch Obler's Lights Out from radio's golden era worked so well. They let the listener create his own special effects in what King calls skull cinema. As King once told Muller regarding straight readings, the recording seems a lot closer to the mind of the writer than any other kind of adaptation. The dramatized version is recorded in binaural sound, which uses a special microphone to give the illusion of three-dimensional sound. The unsettling effect is substantially enhanced when wearing headphones. Case in point, when I was writing the first edition of this book in 1988, in the basement of a three-level townhouse, it was late at night, and I was listening to the ZBS recording with headphones on. My basement had two doors to storage areas. At one critical point in the recording, a door suddenly slammed shut, and I nearly shat my pants. I had thought for a frightening moment that someone had come in out of nowhere, perhaps by way of the storage room door, with a bloody axe in hand, imagining a scene from the kind of illustration Bernie Wrightson delights in drawing. That's how convincing the ZBS recording is. And as for my nearly soiling myself, I think the folks at ZBS would have been proud. They wanted to make the unreal appear real, and succeeded brilliantly. I can't recall a time my heart beat faster than that night. I immediately shut the recording off and went upstairs, leaving the late hour and the darkness behind me. If you've not heard the dramatization of The Mist, I recommend reading the story and then reliving it with a 3D audio recording. I can think of no finer introduction to King, since in this horror story, King achieves the most difficult of writing tasks, convincing the reader to suspend disbelief. As I write this, I'm in the basement of another house, which has several doors, and it's late at night. I've got headphones on, and the dramatization of The Mist on my desk. But having an aversion to self-soiled clothing, I'll wait until daylight to give it a repeat hearing. 30. Frank Darabont on The Mist. An interview conducted by Hans Oke Lilja. January 7, 2008. Entire books have been written about movies based on King's writings. Some have been critical analyses, but most have been pop culture overviews, heavy with stills and anecdotal information, focused on the movie-making process in front of and behind the camera. To date, no book has been published on King's movies that comprehensively puts them all in context and explains why some have worked so well and others are cinematic embarrassments. Similarly, no book of interviews with directors who have filmed King projects has been published, which would make for compelling reading. In looking at the many interviews that have been published over the years, I wanted to reprint one that most people will not have read, an interview that wasn't published in a general interest fan magazine or film magazine. I also wanted to pick an interview that I thought served the reader instead of being a fluff piece on the director. In other words, I wanted a no-holds-barred, straight-shooting director who doesn't mince words. I chose Frank Darabont. I think you'll agree with me that his insights on the movie-making process and his discussion of being involved in one of his favorite King stories, The Mist, is compelling reading. Lilja, last time we talked, you were about to shoot The Mist, and now it's done and has had its premiere. Are you happy with the result? Frank Darabont. Delighted. It was deeply satisfying to put this story I've loved for so long on film. The result is the story I always saw in my head when reading the book, and I'm very happy to say that Stephen King loves the movie. That's our best endorsement, as well as my greatest personal satisfaction, the fact that it pleases him. Also very satisfying for me was the opportunity to try a completely different stylistic approach from anything I'd ever done before as a director, which was very exhilarating and liberating for me. It was a blast, tremendously fun in that regard, and a great learning experience. Mostly, I'm very happy that we accomplished what we set out to do, which was to make a movie on a low budget and a very tight schedule. For the record, it was $17 million and a 37-day shoot. That's not much money these days when major studios are regularly making genre films in the $100 to $200 million budget range. Our goal was to make an ambitious movie with limited resources, very much in the spirit of the grainy, low-budget genre films I grew up watching and loving. Lilja. Personally, I really liked The Mist. In fact, I think it's the best adaptation of a King story to date. What reaction have you gotten on the film? Does everybody like it as much as I do? Darabont. Thanks. I'm so glad you like it. Overall, reactions have been very gratifying. A lot of people love it and have blessed us with lavish praise. One critic said it's the best movie of the year and one of the best horror movies ever. I don't know if that's true. Time is the only real judge of these things. But I appreciate the opinion. The people who have embraced the movie love it for the raw quality, the intensity, and the uncompromising ending. Of course, there are some people who hate it, too. And I think for those very same reasons. It's real and harsh in a way they don't expect. I think they went in expecting a popcorn monster movie with some thrills and a typical ending. A date night movie, basically. But that's not what they got. They got a bleak, nasty movie that kicked them in the stomach and said some deeply negative things about humanity they weren't prepared to hear. That's not the sort of thing they expect from just a horror movie, so it pisses them off. That's okay. You're allowed to hate my movie as much as you're allowed to love it. I always say there's never been a movie that was loved by everybody. I can read you a few scathingly bad reviews I got for The Shawshank Redemption when it first came out. But with The Mist, I set out to make a horror movie, which by my definition is intended to horrify and disturb you. If the movie did that, I succeeded. Some people love those sensations and admire the result. Some people don't. They'd rather go through the motions of a scary movie, but not get kicked in the stomach. They prefer horror that doesn't get too real. And The Mist got too real for some people, especially at the end. And that's fair, too. Like I said, there's never been a movie that pleases everybody. What I love is that the film provokes strong reactions either way, but nobody's walking out unaffected by it. And that delights me, because I don't want to make a movie that leaves you unaffected, which is the worst way a film can fail. Especially a horror film. The films I've loved most in the genre didn't pull their punches. They wanted to fuck with my head. Mind you, I'm not comparing my movie with anybody else's or claiming similar greatness. That would be arrogant and idiotic of me. But Night of the Living Dead leaps to mind. Man, do I love that film. What a subversive piece of filmmaking that was in its day. And it certainly didn't let us off the hook with warm platitudes or a misplaced happy ending. Instead, it kicked us in the stomach. So did Carpenter's The Thing, another admirably disturbing and subversive film. And Cronenberg's The Fly, another masterpiece. Again, I'm not comparing. I'm just bringing these movies up because they've always been genre inspirations for me. Iconic high points that took their shit seriously and said something about the human condition. They were made for adults, not the teen date crowd. They did what horror should do. Take chances. Say something. Risk pissing you off. The Thing certainly pissed a lot of people off when it was originally released in 1982, though I thought it was a classic the moment I saw it. Lilia. And what an ending. I just loved it. I still have goosebumps from seeing it. I must admit that it's even better than the one King wrote in the original story. Did you have to fight to get everyone to agree on having such a dark and sad ending? Darabont. You can't have an ending as downbeat as this without many people questioning it along the way, especially on the business end. It certainly scared off a lot of financiers who were otherwise prepared to fund the film. I had a meeting with one producer, very well known, a guy with his own mini-studio. He was prepared to make the movie for $30 million and offered to write me the check before I even left the room. But he insisted I had to change the ending. It was a tempting offer, but also one of those do-I-sell-out-or-not moments in life. I asked him what he thought the ending should be. He had no idea. All he knew was that he wanted it to be any ending but this one. I told him I had no idea either, that this was the only ending that made sense to me, and I'd been thinking about it for 20 years. So we shook hands and parted ways. I suppose for the sake of the money, I could have come up with some other ending. But the truth is, I didn't want to sell out. I never have before, and saw no reason to start now. I think it would have been lame to tack on a conclusion that let the main character and the audience off the hook. What would that even be? Suddenly The Mist parts and the National Guard is handing them coffee and donuts and putting blankets on their shoulders? How obvious and not real. It makes me cringe. So I ended up making the movie for Bob Weinstein, the only guy with the balls to say, "Hey, I love this. Let's make this movie." Of course, I had to make the movie for almost half the money the other guy had offered me, $17 million instead of 30. That involved all the typical things. I didn't take a directing salary up front. Everybody was working for reduced fees. We had to very strictly control the spending, etc. But at least I got to make the movie my way. I'm sure some people will think I'm a moron for walking away from all that dough, and others will admire my integrity. And you know, both opinions are fair. But it's not as if I had a choice, really. I have to make the movie I see in my head. I can't render somebody else's creative vision. I can only render my own, for better or worse. It's not even ego. The path I have to follow is the one that makes sense to me. Otherwise, I'd have no idea what the hell I'm doing. Lilia, how did you get to think of such a grim ending? I can't even imagine how David feels when he sees the military arriving. Darabont, it's funny. Most people assume I came up with that ending entirely on my own. Even Stephen King thought so. And I haven't yet gone on record to dispute that notion, but I will do so now. Here's the truth. The idea for that ending is right out of Stephen King's book, and I told him so when we were in New York together doing the press junket for the movie. He asked me where I'd gotten the idea. I said, "Steve, I got it from you. Look at this line in your story, here in the last chapter. We're hearing David's thoughts near the end, and it says, 'There are three bullets in the gun. There are four of us in the car. If worse comes to worse, I'll figure a way out for myself.'" I'm paraphrasing that line right now, but that's essentially what it says. Steve got this great look on his face when I told him this, because I think he'd forgotten that he ever wrote it. So all I did was take King's darkest thought and follow it to its most logical and horrible conclusion. The idea for the movie's ending is right there in the original text. I didn't just come up with an idea out of the blue and tack it onto Steve's story. I did what I always do when adapting King or any other author. Look for clues in the story that give me insight into the author's thinking and that I can make dramatic use of. I did the same thing quite a bit when adapting Shawshank and The Green Mile. Lilia, I just couldn't believe what I saw. And even if it sounds harsh, I really like that we didn't get that typical Hollywood ending where all turns out for the best. Darabont, thanks, me too. Here's my favorite anecdote about the ending. We did a test screening of the film in Burbank. Two guys came up to me afterward with tears in their eyes and said, "Frank, we love this movie, but we begged you to change the ending. It's too much." After they were gone, two different guys came up, also with tears in their eyes, and said, "Frank, we love this movie. We begged you not to change the ending. It's perfect." As I said, it polarizes audiences. I always figured it would. That's why I was willing to make the movie so cheaply. I always recognized we were taking a risk, but I also knew if we made it cheaply enough, the movie would still earn a profit. As you can imagine, I'm very grateful to Bob Weinstein for taking that risk with me. Lilia, now I guess we just have to wait for the Oscar nominations to see how many The Mist gets. Both The Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile have been nominated, and even though it's harder for a horror movie to be nominated, there are a lot of actors in The Mist who ought to be. Darabont, I appreciate your kind thought, but there's no way we'll get any nominations. A low-budget horror movie like ours isn't even on the Oscar radar screen. I do agree my actors would be deserving of recognition for the work they've done. Perhaps they'd get that recognition if they'd been in another kind of movie, but not this one. Lilia, your next Stephen King movie is The Long Walk, right? Where are you with that one now? Is a script written? Darabont, there isn't a script yet. I plan to write it this year. Lilia, I guess that script will demand a lot if you're going to succeed in making it into a feature film. The Long Walk is one of my favorite books, but you must admit that it's not the first book you're thinking of when you think of a Stephen King book being turned into a movie. What got you hooked on that particular book? And aren't you worried that it's not doable as a movie? Darabont. What makes The Long Walk a great story is how stripped down and spare it is. Not much plot, just kids walking, talking, and dying. It's a very existential work. Stephen King meets Eugene Ionesco. And that's what I love about it. It's small and fascinating and weird, and I think the movie should be too. It's more of an art house movie, the way Steve wrote it. I don't want to reinvent it or blow it out of proportion to justify it as a big commercial film, which is how they screwed up The Running Man. I'm not sure it's even possible with material like The Long Walk. Of course, doing it faithfully means I'd have to do it cheaply. Far more cheaply than The Mist. But at least I can stay true to what Steve wrote. Perhaps as a cool little film for HBO or Showtime. Lilia. Last time you also mentioned The Monkey. Any news on that one? Darabont. I'm hoping to write that script this year, too. We'll see how it turns out. It might make a good theatrical feature. We'll see. Lilia. Any other King/Darabont collaborations that you can talk about? Darabont. We're going to have a baby through in vitro fertilization. No, that's not true. I'm just messing around. I should know better because that's how rumors get started. Lilia, what else are you up to? I guess you might be taking a well-deserved break now that The Mist is done. Darabont. Yes, I need it. I've never made a movie this quickly. We started prepping the film in January and we finished everything at the end of October. 10 months of production from start to finish. Plus, I did a few months prior to that, casting actors with Deb and designing monsters with Nicotero. So, maybe 12 months for me in all? I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I proved I could do it. But I don't want to do it that way often. It kills you. It's intense and exhausting. What I learned making The Mist is that it's just as hard making a $17 million movie as it is making a $67 million film like Green Mile. But with a bigger budget, you at least have the additional advantage of time. 31. Cujo, 1981. There is no higher tribute to the effectiveness of a writer of fiction than when a phrase or title becomes part of the greater lexicon. Cujo. As a word image of the friendly and familiar suddenly turned monstrous, is another phrase that has entered our collective consciousness. Dan Simmons, Introduction to Cujo, 1994. Over the years, readers have asked King the question he most dreads: where do you get your ideas? Like other writers, he usually makes a humorous joke out of it, because it's a question that doesn't lend itself to a soundbite. In this instance, however, King knows exactly where he got the idea for this novel. He told Winter in The Art of Darkness that in the spring of 1977, outside of Bridgeton, Maine, he took his ailing motorcycle to a mechanic who had this huge Saint Bernard that came out of the barn growling. The owner, recalled King, slapped the dog's rump and got it to stop, and the idea of writing about a large, out-of-control dog leaped forward. It's a great shaggy dog story, but critics are divided about the novel's status in King's canon. Writer Dan Simmons, in an introduction to the 1994 collector's edition of Cujo, explained that the novel is more than what it seems. It's a serious horror novel on more levels than one. I am going to suggest that Cujo is not really about a rabid dog. I submit that it is about something even more terrifying. It is about a parent's ultimate nightmare, the inability to protect one's child when the universe suddenly grows fangs. Winter's assessment is that it's one of King's best novels and cites its exploration of reality as a strength. It's stripping away of supernaturalism to confront us with the mundane here and now, to support its thesis that reality is an unnatural order. But others, including Michael Collings, have a bone to pick. Specifically, in Cujo, almost every key event seems accidental. As he wrote in The Stephen King Companion, 1995, in King's stronger pieces, there is frequently an underlying current of purposefulness approaching tragedy. Characters make important decisions and then must accept the consequences of those actions. Cujo remains a tweener, a novel captured between two opposing states of storytelling, and as a result, it is weakened. Originally conceived as a Bachman novel, it's the story of a rabid St. Bernard that attacks and kills both its owner, Joe Camber, and Joe's pal, Gary Pervier, and then lays siege to Donna Trenton and her son Tad, who are trapped in their Ford Pinto. Though Donna survives, Tad does not. He dies of dehydration, which understandably upsets readers who wanted him to live. A relentless, grim, in-your-face novel, Cujo marks a departure from King's previous novels, which have overt elements of horror or the supernatural. In this novel, though, the horrors of everyday life, told through the Trenton family's efforts to simply stay alive during a difficult time economically, hits closer to home. The economic hardship experienced by the Trentons could happen to any of us, if the Wheel of Fortune spins and we find ourselves in an unfortunate circumstance. Riding with Stephen King by Susie Thayer. One day in 1977, I went with three friends to see the movie The Deep at a theater in Westbrook, Maine. It had been my idea to take a taxi from Portland, so as we were leaving and realized we were all low on cash, it was up to me to find a ride back to Portland. I spotted a lone man with a friendly-looking face leaving the theater and asked if he might give four poor women a ride to Portland. He happily obliged and led us to a big, sleek-looking black car. I wouldn't be so quick to hop in these days. I sat in the back seat behind him, where I could see his eyes in the rearview mirror. They looked familiar. Then I noticed a metal plaque on the dashboard that read, "Stephen and Tabitha King." I said loudly, "Oh my God, guess who's driving this car?" King laughed. When asked what he was working on, he told us he was just starting a story about a rabid St. Bernard. Cujo hadn't even been named yet. Coming Clean, King's Addiction. Most of King's constant readers, who thought they knew everything there was to know about him, were surprised to discover that, as he confessed in On Writing, he is a recovered alcoholic and drug user. It got so bad that, as he explained, "At the end of my adventures, I was drinking a case of 16-ounce tall boys a night, and there's one novel, Cujo, that I barely remember writing at all. I don't say that with pride or shame, only with a vague sense of sorrow and loss. I like that book. I wish I could remember enjoying the good parts as I put them down on the page." King's choices: Straighten Up and Fly Right, or Crash and Burn. Pilots call it augering into the ground. To King's credit, he straightened up and flew straight. At its worst moments, though, things looked pretty bleak. During an intervention, Tabitha King had gone around the house, collected the detritus of his various addictions, and, as he recounted in On Writing, dramatically emptied a trash bag full of stuff from my office out on the rug. Beer cans, cigarette butts, cocaine in gram bottles and cocaine in plastic baggies, Coke spoons caked with snot and blood, Valium, Xanax, bottles of Robitussin cough syrup and NyQuil cold medicine, even bottles of mouthwash. The reader engaging in pop psychology might speculate that King suffered from self-esteem problems or that he was clearly running away from reality and seeking escape through substance abuse. But the simple fact is that it takes trained medical professionals to diagnose and treat such addiction, which is a very serious matter. So let's not speculate. You have to give King credit. He came clean, both in stepping forward to admit it and in taking steps to overcome it, and accepted full responsibility for his actions. In the end, he realized that creative people probably do run a greater risk of alcoholism and addiction than those in some other jobs, but so what? We all look pretty much the same when we're puking in the gutter. King finally conquered his demons. 32. Danse Macabre, 1981. I think the most important thing I learned from Stephen King, I learned as a teenager, reading King's book of essays on horror and on writing, Danse Macabre. In there, he points out that if you just write a page a day, just 300 words, at the end of a year, you'd have a novel. It was immensely reassuring. Suddenly, something huge and impossible became strangely easy. As an adult, it's how I've written books I haven't had the time to write. Like my children's novel, Coraline. Neil Gaiman, The King and I. Sunday Times Magazine, UK, April 28, 2012. In the dedication to Danse Macabre, King writes, "It's easy enough, perhaps too easy, to memorialize the dead. This book is for six great writers of the macabre who are still alive." He cited Robert Bloch, Jorge Luis Borges, Ray Bradbury, Frank Belknap Long, Donald Wandre, and Manly Wade Wellman. When King's book was published in 1979, all six were alive and well. Now, with the passage of time, they are all gone, but we are left with a body of work that continues to impress, delight, and entertain. To borrow a phrase from Monsters, Inc., they care enough to scare. I was fortunate enough to see Bradbury at several public events, at which he was always accommodating to fans. He especially loved to attend the San Diego Comic-Con, even if it meant having someone transport him in a wheelchair. The last time I saw him was at SDCC, with a big smile, like a kid in a candy store, as he took in the sensory overload and spectacle of the event, in all its splendor and gaudiness. I also met Manly Wade Wellman, a gentleman from North Carolina who attended the one-day Durham mini-cons, which were held at the home of Edwin and Terry Murray, whose unparalleled collection of pop culture, comic books, science fiction, fantasy, and horror, now resides in the special collections of Duke University, which both men attended. Like Bradbury and Wellman, Stephen King is a master in the horror field, and like them, he's a fan at heart. Attendees at the 5th World Fantasy Convention recall seeing him walk around the dealer's room, where stacks of pulp magazines, hardback books, and other collectibles commanded his attention. It was the time for him to round out some holes in his collection and get them signed by other writers in attendance who shared with him their love of the field. That's what fandom is all about. What makes Danse Macabre unique among King's works is that it is his first nonfiction book, an extended love letter to the genre of fantastic literature, science fiction, fantasy, and supernatural horror, and its practitioners. The book was written at a time when researching the subject meant spending time in the library, calling up people to get information, buying or borrowing publications of interest, and hunting down rare items from rare book dealers. These days, the internet makes such tasks immensely easier, but what it can't do is take all these disparate elements and bring them together in a whole. That requires a lot of analysis and synthesis, which is what English majors are trained to do, and King, a former English major, did just that in Danse Macabre, an accessible text written for a general audience. The book's genesis, as King points out in his forenote, can be credited to King's former book editor at Doubleday, William G. Thompson. It was Bill who called King in November 1978 with a suggestion and a challenge. Why don't you do a book about the entire horror phenomenon as you see it? Books, movies, radio, TV, the whole thing. The timing was right. King, who was preparing to teach a class at the University of Maine at Orno, Themes in Supernatural Literature, realized that it was his opportunity to kill two birds with one stone. In doing the homework for the book, he'd be prepping for the class itself, and he'd be able to publish a book that shared his enthusiasm for the field with his readers. Everest House issued the trade edition, and Otto Penzler's The Mysterious Press issued the signed limited edition. The editor at Everest House was, you guessed it, William G. Thompson, who had moved there after being forced to leave Doubleday. The resultant book is a detailed, informal, and entertaining overview of the horror field. Appropriately, the book's title is referred to in October 4, 1957, and An Invitation to Dance, the first chapter's title. I think the Milwaukee Journal nailed it when describing the book. Danse Macabre is a conversation with Stephen King. It's comfortable and easygoing. At the same time, it's perceptive and knowledgeable. A visit with a craftsman who has honed his skills to an edge that cuts clean and sparkles with brilliance. The Baltimore Sun stated it succeeds on any number of levels. As pure horror memorabilia for longtime ghoulie groupies, as a bibliography for younger addicts weaned on King, and as an insightful non-credit course for would-be writers of the genre. Michael Collings wrote, "Anyone associating the terms critical, academic, and scholarly with a book claiming to be the results of university courses or a disquisition on the development of a literary genre will be pleasantly relieved to discover early in Danse Macabre that just because King is writing nonfiction, he has not left behind the distinctive narrative voice that had already become his trademark. Although the book is a cogent and concise study of dark fantasy, it is also clearly from the mind and pen of Stephen King, replete with personal reminiscences that in turn set the stage for conclusions about the functions, nature, and purposes of horror. Amply illustrated with black and white photos, the book covers radio, movies, television, and books. In other words, it thoroughly covers the field. The book is especially useful for its discussion on radio. As King explains, I am of the last quarter of the last generation that remembers radio drama as an active force, a dramatic art form with its own set of reality. If you have any interest in the field whatsoever, the book will repay multiple readings. For newcomers, King's list of recommended movies and books is a good starting point. There's plenty of source material here, and it'll take a chunk of time for you to watch the movies and read the books. Now, 35 years down the road, it's time for a young writer to essay the field anew, bringing the book's contents current, because so much has happened in the field, notably with films and books. But King's book still remains the best single source overview of the field that he so obviously loves, and loves to write about when the opportunity arises. 33. Stephen King's Creepshow, 1982. It's like the proverbial roller coaster ride, where you laugh and you scream, and it doesn't leave a bad taste in your mouth. You just feel like, wow, that was great. Let's go do it again. Stephen King, on the movie Creepshow. Creepshows by Stephen Jones. King's graphic novel, Creepshow, consists of five stories drawn in full color by Bernie Wrightson. It's unique among King's books because it's drawn from a movie with a screenplay written by Stephen King. The 1982 movie, which took $8 million to make and had veteran horror film director George Romero at the helm, grossed, a rather apt word, I must say, $21 million domestically at the box office. A sequel, Creepshow 2, released in 1987, didn't fare as well. It earned only $14 million in domestic box office receipts. The film was inspired by editor Bill Gaines's Entertaining Comics, EC Comics, line of horror comic books, Tales from the Crypt, The Vault of Horror, and The Haunt of Fear. The comics are collector's items, which prompted Russ Cochran to reprint them in sturdy, full-color hardback books, which have a place of honor in Stephen King's book collection. The movie opens with a scene familiar to all too many comic book fans, whose parents, mine included, considered comic books to be trash, to which they were quickly consigned. The 8-year-old boy in bed, reading his comic at night, looks familiar. He's Joe Hill King. Joe Hill makes a brief appearance, but Stephen King is front and center in one of the 5 stories, The Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill. The short story version, titled Weeds, appeared in the May 1976 issue of Cavalier magazine. In the film version, King plays the part of a Maine farmer who discovers that a meteor has landed on his property. He hopes to cash in by selling it to the local university, until it breaks open, spilling its green-colored goo, causing him to itch insanely. Like an alien kudzu, the meteor shit slowly covers his house, his yard, and finally him. For his role, noted Stephen Jones in his film study Creep Shows, to create the plant effect, King wore latex makeup appliances created by Tom Savini for the early stages of the growth, and dyed yak and horsehair was glued directly onto his face and hands. "I just wanted to cover him in moss. Make him itch," joked Romero. The bottom line, according to King, from Ann Lloyd's The Films of Stephen King, "I'm happy with Creepshow because I was involved with the entire thing, from beginning to end, and the writing process was original." It was all in good fun for King, who loved its connection to the horror comics of the past. "As a kid," wrote King in Danse Macabre, "I cut my teeth on William B. Gaines's horror comics. These horror comics of the 50s still sum up for me the epitome of horror, that emotion of fear that underlines terror, an emotion which is slightly less fine, because it is not entirely of the mind." The comic book. The original idea the studio pitched was a straightforward novelization, which King rejected because it wasn't in the spirit of the movie. The only way King would allow a tie-in was if it made sense visually, and that meant a comic book adaptation. King turned to Bernie Wrightson, who cut his teeth illustrating horror comics for Marvel, DC, and Warren Publishing. Working from the movie and King's script, Bernie had a blast illustrating the 64-page comic published as a trade paperback, for which he rendered pencils and finished ink. The coloring was done by his former wife, Michelle. The cover was drawn by EC Comics artist Jack Kamen, showing a boy in bed at night reading a 10-cent comic titled Creepshow, with posters decorating his bedroom wall, George Romero's Dawn of the Dead, The Shining, and Carrie. A hooded, skeletal figure peers in through the boy's window, illuminated by a full moon in the background. Of the 5 stories, 2 stand out because of the outstanding artwork. Bernie excels in depicting monsters, and so The Crate is memorable, with its werewolf-like creature, as is The Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill, which recalls the humorous flavor of Wrightson's Uncle Bill's Barrel and his work for the DC comic Swamp Thing. Bernie, in an interview for Knowing Darkness, concurred, "I probably put the most work into The Crate and Jordy Verrill. Those were my 2 favorite segments from the movie. The Crate, because it's a movie within a movie, and Jordy Verrill, because it was played for laughs." 34. Drawn to Darkness. Bernie Wrightson. an artist inspired by Stephen King. For the privileged few who bought any edition of Salem's Lot from Centipede Press, you own one of the finest examples of specialty publishing in our field. The One Man Press, based in Denver, Colorado, is run by a high-energy, enthusiastic guy named Jared Walters, whose sense of aesthetics in terms of book design is second to none. Like an Arkham House book published when August Derleth was at the helm, a Centipede Press book is singularly distinctive. Jared also has what I consider to be an essential quality for any man crazy enough to run a one-person small press. He has the capacity to take infinite pains. He's detailed-oriented and sweats the small stuff. He followed up his gorgeous edition of Salem's Lot with another Stephen King-related title, Knowing Darkness, Artists Inspired by Stephen King, which I wrote. That tombstone-sized book is also out of print, and it too sported first-class production values. The 1,500-copy slipcase edition cost $395. The 300-copy tray case edition cost $895, and the 25-copy lettered edition cost $4,995. In his introduction to the book, film director Frank Darabont shares a telling anecdote about a phone conversation he had with Stephen King years before Jared independently came up with the same idea. Frank's idea? King should put all that art together and publish it as a huge book. Call it The Art of Stephen King. King's response, Jesus.